Welcome to Politics in Question, the podcast where we ask the big questions about our political institutions, why they are failing, and what we can do to fix them. I'm Lee Dorotman, a senior fellow at New America.
And I'm James Wallner. I'm a senior fellow at the R Street Institute and a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Clemson University.
So there's kind of a big structural imbalance in American democracy. It comes from geography and the way geography interacts with our political institutions, the Senate and by extension the Electoral College, both overweight, sparsely populated states. So by extension, rural America is overrepresented. Yet there's a real narrative of disempowerment and left behindness and anger that is emanating from rural America, and many see this as contributing to the rise of Donald Trump and with some potentially devastating consequences for our democracy. And this is a big question in our politics, this urban-rural divide and the way it plays on our cultural divides and our political institutions. So I'm delighted that we have on the podcast today the authors of a new book called White Rural Rage, The Threat to American Democracy. And the two authors are political scientist Thomas Schaller, who's a professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, and the journalist Paul Waldman, who's a columnist for MSNBC, co-host of the podcast Boundary Issues, and longtime columnist of the Washington Post. So welcome to the show, Tom and Paul. Delighted to have you as part of this conversation.
Thanks.
Thanks.
So let's start off by situating this book in a particular place. You discuss Mingo County, West Virginia. What's the deal with Mingo County?
It's a very interesting place historically. If people are familiar with the John Sayles film Matewan, that took place during the what's called the Mine Wars that happened right at the start of the 20th century. That was a kind of real bloody history, and the nickname that the county still has today is Bloody Mingo, because it was the site of a lot of labor unrest, a real kind of almost an outright war. I think it was the largest insurrection since the Civil War that occurred there between the coal companies and the public officials who were operating on their behalf and coal miners who were just asking for a little bit better treatment and a little better pay. So it has this history of labor unrest. But one of the interesting things about it now is that even though there is still coal mining in the area a little bit, and there is this long history of the coal industry that kind of hangs over everything in that area, there's really very little union presence anymore. And this is a place that was, you know, almost entirely Democratic that flipped to being almost entirely Republican. And that's true of West Virginia generally, but it's especially true of Mingo County. It's one of the poorest counties in the area, and it has this kind of interesting political transformation that happened. So, for instance, when we were there, we talked to Truman Chafin, who used to be the majority leader of the West Virginia State Senate, and he was the county chair of the Mingo County Democratic Party for a long time. And one of the things that he told us was that in his day, which ended, I think, in 2014 was when he was booted out of office when the Republicans took over. In his day, the county Democratic chair was kind of the center of the entire political life of the county. He was the guy you went to if you needed to get something fixed. You know, if there was a pothole near your house or whatever it was, the county chair was the guy who kept all the systems running. And he said, now you can't even get anybody to take the job. But it's not because the Republican Party has such a strong presence there. The Republican Party doesn't have much of a presence either. And this is something that's indicative of a lot of rural areas. Even though Donald Trump won, I think it was 83% of the vote in 2016 and then 85% of the vote in Mingo County in 2020, the Republican Party isn't a presence in people's lives because they don't have to be. They know that they're going to get all those votes. They don't have to provide any kind of comprehensive services to people. And Mingo County is one of a lot of places in rural America that has been exploited again and again and again by different kinds of powerful people. They were exploited by the timber industry, then they were exploited by the coal industry, then they were exploited by the pharmaceutical industry, which poured millions of doses of opioids into Mingo County, created a terrible addiction problem. And now they're exploited I think in a lot of ways by the Republican Party, which basically is taking all their votes, but not providing much of anything for them. And this is one of the stories that we try to tell, is that in a lot of rural places, they have been in a way sort of depoliticized, because when you get these huge margins for one party, well, the Democrats look at that and say, well, we're not going to try to get votes in a place like that. You know, who cares? It's not going to do anything. We're never going to win. And the Republican Party looks at it and says, well, we don't have to do anything to get votes. We're going to get all the votes. And so you get a politics where there's no presence from either of the parties. There's no competition. And therefore, the constituents don't really even have a means to get what they want from the government. And they don't even think that they can. And politics winds up being about nothing more than, you know, occasionally expressing some anger at the polls.
This paints a pretty pessimistic of our politics writ large, and speaks to some larger issues that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about over these last few years, the decline of parties generally, that the Democratic Party as an organization has just transformed tremendously from being a presence in many people's lives to just being a sort of a national network of pollsters and campaign operatives. And it's true of the Republican Party as well, and also the decline of competition. So I want to ask a little bit about the way in which the Democratic Party has retreated from a lot of these places. Because one of the arguments that you make in the book is that actually, at a policy level, Democrats have tried to take the economic conditions and the material conditions of folks in rural America quite seriously. If you look at the investments they're making in a carbon reduction economy, they're making a lot of investments in rural areas, and they seem to have an interest in spending to improve life in those areas. But is the problem that they need to do a lot more, that these investments are somewhat marginal given the problems in a lot of these places? Is the problem that Democrats are just not showing up and that they have no credible ambassadors to a lot of these places? What's the deal with that, Tom?
Well, first of all, if you Google rural America and Democrats, just do it after the show. 80% of the hits, and certainly all the top hits, are about how the Democrats have failed rural America, how they don't go there, how they're condescending, how they don't reach out. This is a party that's won the popular vote 7 of the last 8 presidential elections, and they are still expected to reach out and try to convince the voters least likely to vote for them to vote for them. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, the party that's lost the popular vote in 7 of the last 8 presidential elections, you never see them saying, hey, they need to reach out to cities. They need to talk to gay people. They need to talk to liberals in the cities. In fact, Republicans not only don't do that and aren't lectured to do that. And by the way, the Democrats are lectured by people like Tom Vilsack, by other Democrats, to go to rural America. Not only do Republicans not do that, they do things like J.D. Vance saying, I got to go to New York City. Is it more like season 1 or season 4 of The Walking Dead, implying that it's a zombie apocalypse? You have Donald Trump saying, you know, it's crime dens in the cities, even though the crime rates have been going down for 30 years in urban America, which is an unquestioned fact. But you wouldn't know that if you were in rural America, because they think cities are hellscapes. You have Marjorie Taylor Greene during COVID saying it looks like a bombed out Washington, D.C., as people post pictures from farmers markets and walking their dogs around the streets and the parks. So not only are Republicans allowed to criticize cities openly with impunity, they're rewarded for doing that, even though they're the party that's lost 7 of the last 8 presidential elections. Meanwhile, what are Democrats doing? Well, here's a few examples. For one, as we know from Jonathan Metzl, who studied the healthcare metrics in Tennessee versus Kentucky. In Kentucky, which immediately adopted the Medicare expansion program under Obamacare, the health metrics immediately improved and the number of uninsured people plummeted in Kentucky. Next door neighbor, Tennessee, one of still 10 states that hasn't adopted Medicaid, has seen just the reverse experience. People dying at greater rates, uninsured rates not moving. In the 9 years after Obamacare was passed, rural uninsured rates dropped from 24% for adults over 18 but under 65 because you're covered by Medicare. Rural uninsurance went from 24% to 16% in 9 years. That's a 1/3 reduction. That means 1 out of 3 rural Americans who didn't have insurance when Obama took office had insurance by the time he left office, basically by 2019, early Trump years. Did they rally to the polls for Democrats like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? No. Joe Biden, in the middle of COVID, created a program to help get rural white Americans who were most wrapped around the axle of all the conspiracies about ivermectin and hydrochloroquine and all these other, you know, holistic alternatives because they were the most resistant to the vaccines. He created a program for vaccine outreach specifically targeted to rural white Americans. He didn't put his name on it. He used faith-based organizations. He used farm-based organizations that had local credibility, reduced the number of people who refused the vaccines, literally saved the lives of the voters least likely to vote for him. And of course, they love him, right? No. Rural voters went voting 62% for Trump in 2016 to 71%. They moved 9 points toward Trump as the country moved net 2 points away from Trump between 2016 and 2020. So Democrats are doing anything. They're not getting any credit for it because people aren't voting for their own interests. They're voting for whatever Fox News and conservative radio tells them is so horrible. And, you know, whatever hellscape is happening in the city is whether it's Nancy Pelosi, even though, you know, a guy like J.D. Vance lives in Cincinnati, which has a higher per capita violent crime rate than New York City that he criticized. So it's hard to get around the culture war emphasis. The Republicans have clearly won the culture war and they're going to run on that till the cows come home, so to speak, because they don't need to deliver any material benefits. And the Democrats are actually delivering some of them and getting next to zero credit for it.
Yeah. And if I could add, you know, if you look at what the Biden administration has done in its signature legislation, the American Rescue Plan and the infrastructure bill and the different things that it has done legislatively, all of them have specific rural components that Democrats put in there. Nobody really even expects Donald Trump to come up with a plan for rural America, but every Democrat does it. And then when they pass legislation, they actually do it. So, you know, they have $45 billion for expanding broadband, much of which is into rural areas. And that's a really important need that rural areas have. There is just a report that came out from the Brookings Institution about the Biden administration's industrial policy and how most of it is focused in, you know, areas like semiconductors and, you know, clean energy. Most of it is focused on traditionally underserved areas that have been, that haven't benefited from the same kind of economic progress that those superstar cities have. So the Biden administration is doing all those things. And, you know, there'll be a story on page A19 when he announces this new initiative that's going to bring a new factory here or there or whatever. But no, that does, that gets, you know, a just a tiny fraction of the attention that the political stuff gets. And perhaps that's understandable, you know, that that policy always gets less attention than politics does, despite the efforts of people like you and this podcast. But that's the reality. And so Democrats are, have this expectation that they're going to do these things, but then when they do them, nobody's going to know about it. They aren't going to get the same kind of credit.
But I mean, it, Tom, you talked about how Democrats are passing these policies, but then sort of trying to take the Democratic fingerprints off them in order to actually implement them. And Kentucky is a great example, right? I mean, the Kentucky version of Obamacare does not have Obama's name on it.
Yeah, it's called Connect, K-Y-N-E-C-T, yeah,
right? Right. And so there's this sense which Democrats are maybe passing some of these policies, but then in order to actually get them implemented, they're trying to make them seem like they're not Democratic policies.
And which why is that, Lee? Because if you called it Obamacare, people wouldn't sign up for it. Just like if Biden came down and said, I'm trying to get rural people to get vaccinated, they wouldn't do it. So Obama and Biden are literally engaging in taking away credit for themselves to save the lives of the people least likely to vote for them. And there is a term for that, Lee. It's called leadership. It's called political courage. Name me a program where Republicans are trying to save the lives of urban minorities or any of their least likely voters and doing it without taking credit for it. Maybe the child care tax credit, which they sometimes support, or the earned income tax credit, which, by the way, rural people depend on more than urban people now.
Well, I have one more question, and then I'm going to turn it over to James. And you know, the question is about what you describe as a vicious political circle, or what one might call a doom loop. I, of course, see doom loops everywhere.
It's a great expression, doom loop.
Yeah, somebody should write a book called The Doom Loop. I assign that in my Poly 100 classes, as you know.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. So you describe it as despair, distraction, disillusionment, and democratic decline spiral. So give us a sense of how these four Ds all feed on each other and what's going on there.
Well, we have a chapter in the book that's about the problems of rural America that everybody kind of understands in broad terms, that the problems of brain drain and the jobs that left as a consequence of globalization and the healthcare challenges. All of these things have caused a great deal of suffering in rural America. And then you combine that with the fact that people really don't feel like the political system is a proper avenue for them to get some kind of relief, some kind of redress. And this was something that, you know, when Donald Trump, you know, for all the different kinds of lies that he told and the ugly things about his appeal, when he came and said the system is rigged against you and neither party has been helping you, that was true. And that really resonated with people. Now, the problem is that he didn't really offer much of a practical way out. And so when you convince people that neither party has anything to offer them, that politics isn't going to be a place where they can go and engage and therefore get something that will actually fix the problems in their community, but it's only a place where you can just like tell everyone how pissed off you are at the people you've been told to hate, then that really undermines people's support for fundamental democratic values and the belief that this is a system that is actually supposed to solve our problems. And that's really, really dangerous when you get that kind of widespread belief that there's nothing that you can get out of politics engaging in a way that's truly fits within our values and our constitutional system. And you know, we contrast that with some of the other groups of people who have been genuinely oppressed by the government and how they have reacted in the past. You know, Black people didn't, when their civil rights were denied them, they didn't grab guns and take over the state house. They didn't, you know, gay people, in order to get their rights, they didn't try to overthrow an election and rampage through the Capitol building. That was not the kind of political engagement that those oppressed groups engaged in. And I think that too often, the message that people in rural America are being told is, everything is rigged against you. The political system cannot offer you a path to a better life, and all that's necessary is for you to just tear it down. That's the only alternative. If you don't get what you want, the answer is to turn against democracy. And so that's how all these kinds of factors can combine to create something very threatening.
James?
Well, thank you. And thank you for coming on the show. I read the book. I've got too many notes to even try to organize my thoughts right now. But I just want to start off by saying, one of your premises, which is that the system doesn't work and that leads people to become frustrated and then apathetic, I think is 100%, so far as I can see, accurate. And I think it is not unique to rural America. I think you see it in Black America. I think you see it in Brown America. I think you see it in all Americans right now. And I think that we see this tendency. And when we realized that we weren't polarized in the academy, even though we have been saying we were polarized, now we call it effective polarization, where we just point to each other and say they're the problem and the other. And I do also think, and I want to underscore this, that the other is a very dangerous concept. This idea that there is another, you know, somebody who is somehow so problematic that they can't even participate in politics, that they themselves become a threat to politics. And this is, you know, it's always been there in American politics across all kinds of demographics and issues and views. But it to me right now, the extent to which we throw up our hands and instead of jumping into politics and engaging with those that we disagree, and not in some like high-minded way, but like trying to beat them and like actually prevail in debates, but instead say, you know what, we're just going to go home. And then maybe if you get really frustrated, we turn to violence. And people have turned to violence, and I'm not equating anything, but I mean, you know, there was a violent strain in the civil rights movement. Thankfully, Dr. King, which was so brilliant in his doctrine of nonviolence, he was successful, and that's why the civil rights movement was successful. And I think that there's so much there, and I agree that it's got to be so hard to refrain from violence when you are in that position. I can't even begin to imagine it. But politics and violence are the only two ways we have to make collective decisions. And if your politics is closed off to you, then increasingly people turn to violence. That doesn't excuse it by any means. But it is, I think, a problem. But I guess I wanted to ask you about how you define rural America. Then I'm going to ask you a little bit about your kind of underlying assumptions. But is that your definition of rural America too simplistic? And, you know, I grew up Cincinnati's a city. I mean, I grew up in Columbus, Georgia, but I was surrounded, had a kind of rural ethos to it. And I have rural people who lived out in rural America. I'm out fly fishing all the time, which I know is not the, you know, most red, ruby red rural America thing in the world. But like, I'm talking to people all the time. And it seems to me that there is a lot of nuance out there. There is a lot of nuance. And it seems what I took away from this is that rural America is this one thing. And rural white America is this one group of people, and they all think the same thing. And they're all, you know, the January 6ers and everybody else in between, when in reality, it seems to be a lot more nuanced.
And it also seems to be much more top down. I mean, it's like the federal government. It's national parties, the federal government, federal policies. When in reality, rural America has been, in the South in particular, for a very long time, up until very recently, very democratic in local elections. And we still see at local and county and municipal county and state elections in certain places, a kind of split. We've seen that with Manchin in West Virginia. That may be ending, but there is this kind of split here. So, I mean, are we overlooking something when we try to reduce? And I know why we're doing it, because we need to write a book and explain it. But are we overlooking something, or am I not seeing something you are?
Well, look, I mean, it's very difficult to define rural. And we have a note at the end of the book for exactly mm-hmm. this reason. If you look at it by county, or if you look at it about population density, and then even within, say, two rural communities that have equal size and equal population densities, ruralness is also how proximate you are to the suburbs and the city. So two places in northern Minnesota, one of which is 15 miles from Duluth, is going to be a fundamentally less rural area than one that's 75 miles from Duluth in, say, St. Louis County, the largest county geographically east of the Mississippi, which is about 200,000 people, 100,000 who live in Duluth Metro, and 100,000 who live up near the Canadian border. The other issue here is the U.S. government doesn't even agree. Like, some U.S. agencies say about 14% of the population is rural. Others, it's in the low 20s. We settled on, for the sake of just sort of back of the envelope, a kind of standard definition that about 20% of Americans live in rural communities. About one-fourth, it's now 24%, are non-white. So one-fourth of 20, let's just call it 5%. So about 20% of Americans live in rural America. Of those, 15 of that 20%, 75% percentage-wise, is white. And the other 5%, and growing, by the way, is non-white. Native Americans, Latino Americans, and African Americans predominantly. Now, the other issue here is rural consciousness. And if you read some of the literature, Catherine Kramer, Robert Wuthnow, Kristen Lunds Trujillo, who has a great dissertation out of the University of Minnesota, I just had her in my rural politics class last week. Rural consciousness is different because there are people who physically live in a rural area, but they're two retirees who spent their whole lives in New York and they're retired to someplace upstate in the Adirondacks. And then there are people who grew up and, because of brain drain in rural America, left and became doctors and lawyers and accountants and what have you, who live in cities, but they retain their rural consciousness. So just because you physically live in a rural area doesn't mean you have a rural consciousness. And just because you left there doesn't mean, you know, you sort of, the old maxim about you can take the boy out of the country, but not the country out of the boy. And so it's impossible to get an exact figure on what percentage of people live in rural America, A, because the government doesn't agree on this, and various social scientists classify it in different ways, and because people are mobile. Now, people in rural America are the least mobile people. They're the least likely to make an in-state move. They're least likely to make a out-of-state move. They're least likely to own a passport. They're most likely to live within a certain radius of the hometown in which they were born and raised. And we talk about this sedentary and sort of provincialism and why it perhaps explains why they have the most xenophobic attitudes, the most racist attitudes, the most anti-immigrant attitudes, is because they actually live, despite all the talk about bubbles, they live in more of a bubble than people who live in pluralistic suburbs and urban areas today, who have neighbors who look, think, act, and pray differently from them. But that's kind of a separate question, and I'm not sure that's what you're getting at, James.
I would add one thing too, is that even in places that are overwhelmingly one or the other, and this is true of cities and this is true of rural areas, there are always going to be people from the other side there. One of the interesting things that we found as we went around, we would sometimes talk to liberals in these places. And even the conservatives too, one of the things that they told us is that before, let's say 2016, when Donald Trump came along, that there was sort of an absence of things being kind of politically charged. And then people said, you know, things started to change. Things got very kind of hard-edged and angry, and all of a sudden you're having these conflicts, and, you know, something happens. Like we were in Llano, Texas, where they had a conflict over the library and what books are going to go in the library. And again, people we talked to there said, you know, before this thing came up, we all got along and now we're at each other's throats. And even though it's overwhelmingly Republican, you know, there are some liberals there too. And so that's something that I think is a relatively recent development in a lot of places, is that national politics coming in and kind of setting everybody on edge and making some relationships that used to be, you know, perfectly pleasant and nice because people didn't think that much about national politics. Now they are. And that brings up other issues too about the changes in media. You know, one of the things that's happened, I'm sure you guys are well aware, is that that the newspaper industry has suffered terrible declines in recent years, and in so many rural places where there just is no newspaper anymore. And so the only place people are getting their news from is national media, especially Fox News and especially conservative talk radio. And that kind of intensifies that sort of partisanship. And so, yes, there is diversity there. And in a lot of places, it's growing diversity. And that's kind of a whole separate issue about places where immigrants are moving in to formerly all white areas and how that is being embraced in some places. And there's a backlash in other places. But you can get the impression, I think, that just as people think that cities are, you know, entirely Democratic, when that's not really true either. There's some statistic, you know, Donald Trump got more votes in Los Angeles County than in, you know, five different states combined. That's true of rural areas, too, is there are some liberals there. But they feel increasingly under siege, I think.
Yeah, when I say diversity, I mean diversity among white people. Just because you're white and you're rural and you live in rural America, do you think the same thing, lock, stock, and barrel? I mean, one of the things I take away from the book is that rural whites are a like distinct identity that is there is no diversity. And one of the things that I've seen in my own experiences in the South, admittedly, in my own family too. I mean, they disagree on all kinds of stuff. People are fighting over policy. They're fighting over approaches to policy and how we conduct it. And I think one of the other things I struggle with is that, you know, I'm wondering how bounded in time your view of this is. Because it seems to me that rural America, going back to the regulator movements here in South Carolina and North Carolina, Shays Rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion, where that rural America is reacting against what they see as elites controlling everything on the coast, and they're trying to get more representation, better representation, et cetera. Right. And I also see that, you know, rural America has been has suffered horrifically across all demographics since the beginning of America. And we can think about other times in the past where rural America has been intense, you know, economic suffering, poverty, starvation. Right. I mean, like literal, like starvation. This is what like Bobby Kennedy, RFK, when he's going around and he goes on to and he makes this point and he says, look, I've seen starvation on Indian reservations and in coal mining like towns in rural West Virginia or all of West Virginia. But like that's and he's pointing out that kind of similarity. But yet in the past, we haven't maybe people reacted to it the same way. And you mentioned like Trump, and it is more hard edged and charged, but in many respects, that is kind of like we negotiate the non-negotiable in politics. Right? And I'm wondering, like, and one of the things, and I'm kind of jumping ahead here, is that it seems like it's hard edged, and that's a problem. Like people disagree, and they don't have the right view, or they don't agree, and they don't see what was done for them. So therefore, that's a problem. But is that a problem so much as is calling it a problem? For like what I'm talking about is essentially if you tell people you can't be angry, you have to be constructive, right? Which is kind of an undertone here. If you tell people that you just don't know what's good for you, right? You need to do this other thing instead. If you take democratic norms, which are themselves constructed over time and deconstructed, that's the whole essence of norms, and you say that this is the one and only true way of doing things, and then you tell people who don't agree with that they can't participate, and you somehow try to push them out. And I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but we've seen this time and again on the left and the right alike. And it leaves people with it almost encourages them to say, well, what the hell, you know? And I think like, why should I participate, right? If I'm told that I'm just a Neanderthal and I don't know what's good for me, and therefore, you know, I'm a threat when I stand up and try to speak my mind, then maybe I will turn to violence. And I'm not saying that makes it right. It's still wrong. I don't like violence at all. But our system is tough, and it was meant to house that kind of non-negotiating the non-negotiable, right? I mean, and right now things are in such flux, and so we should expect to see more arguments. I mean, arguments aren't a problem, are they? So what if people argue at a school board meeting, or they argue over Donald Trump? Why is that a problem?
Well, first of all, to take your issue about, you know, pluralistic, of course, rural America and even white rural conservative America is pluralistic. We don't argue in the book that every single white rural person is a democratic threat. We just point out through three dozen polls and studies that when you look at one, racism, xenophobia, anti-gay sentiments, that rural whites are on the leading edge there. When you look at conspiracism, belief in election denialism, COVID conspiracism, Obama birtherism, rural whites lead there too. When you look at anti-democratic sentiments, support for white nationalism, support for white Christian nationalism, rural whites are leading there. And when you look at support for violence or justification of violence, like on January 6th, rural whites are there. Frankly, when we started writing this book, we were like, how come nobody's noticed this? Now, the more charitable view is people hadn't noticed. And we're the first to notice it. The less charitable view is that a lot of people have noticed and they don't want to talk about it. And I'm frankly—
But isms kind of make the, sorry to interrupt, but isms, when we get into the world of isms, and I'm not saying that these things, I mean, there are problems, of course, but like when you say ism, the individuals just recede. And all of the nuances and diversity and wonderful things about and the tragic things about American political life recede. And we lose sight of all the things that make politics possible in the first place. When you reduce someone to an ism or someone who is like there, it becomes impossible to do politics. And at that point, are you doing the same thing that you're suggesting that rural America is doing to urban America or whatever?
No, what I'm suggesting is if African Americans turned out to be the most conspiracist people, and if Muslims turned out to be the most anti-democratic people, and if pink hat wearing lady feminists turned out to be most prone to support or justify violence, we'd know about that because the massive conservative media infrastructure would tell us every night and there'd be a permanent chyron on Fox News. But white rural Americans, as I just pointed out, are the leading edge of these four interconnected threads. And nobody's talking about it. If you're going to talk about the fate and state of democracy in the post-Trump era, you have to name names, so to speak. I hate to use a McCarthyite phrase. And these are the people who, again, not all of them and not
the
in
people,
all parts of the country.
But who are the people? Are they all the same
white rural Americans in poll after poll?
And what's the matter with Kansas? I mean, we've been talking about that for a while. We've been talking about...
talking about voting against their material.
Well, who are the people? Like, where are the people? Who are these people? Where do they live? What are they saying? What do they think? Like, they're not an ism. Like, I mean, if the critique against rural America is that they are too simplistic in their view of like what they think is the opposition, then I don't think the answer should be to be the other side of the coin, right? It should be to kind of dive in and look, actually like look at it up close.
Look, I wish their democratic commitments were stronger, James. I'm sure you do, too. But if we're talking about a democracy that's on the knife's edge right now, and by the way, it's not just in America. Rural citizens across the Western world are destabilizing democracies, as comparative theorists will explain to you.
In fact, what does that mean? What is the democratic attachment?
I'll tell you what it means. There's a study we cited in there that shows that when the non-ethnic majority, which is whites in the United States, of course, reaches 22%. We've already reached that. Usually economic populists breach the 50% mark and countries become less stable because the ethnic prevailing majority begins to clamp down on that. That's what it means. That's exactly what it means. And so why wouldn't you call out people who, look, 135 members of the House of Representatives voted against Biden's certification, right? Every single one of them was a Republican. 74% of them represent either purely rural districts or rural suburban districts, according to CityLab's classifications. 21 Republicans voted against giving the gold medal to the We Back the Blue Republican Party's 150 police officers who were injured on January 6th, and 18 of those 21 come from rural districts. Now, many of those people told Liz Cheney, if you read her book, they told the Washington Post and New York Times off the record that they were scared on January 6th, not just for their political livelihoods. They said they were physically scared for their own physical safety and the safety of their families. And they had to vote, even though they admitted to Liz Cheney they knew the election was not stolen. Something is fundamentally wrong, James, is it not? In a democracy.
But where do we adjudicate this?
Let me finish. Something.
No, but hold on. Where do we? No, hold on.
Just
sorry.
Let me finish my thought.
Tom, let me just hold on. Let's push back. One, where do we adjudicate? I think it's helpful to kind of pull out these things that you're talking about. Like, yeah, you're mentioning a lot of stuff and a lot of things that you have particular precise views on. The whole point of politics is that we adjudicate those things inside the realm of political conflict. And what you're saying is, no, these people are a threat. Let's push them out, which is essentially the exact same thing you're arguing.
What about inside the realm of political conflict? That was very much outside the realm of political conflict.
But January 6th wasn't every single white rural American. I was a rural American.
I have something to say about this.
Paul, let me just say real quick,
James.
Too.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. Look, Paul, Chip Roy, for instance, he forced his colleagues to vote on the certification of, and he's like, well, look, if Donald Trump stole the election, then why are we letting all these other people in here? And then he voted against it with all of his Democratic colleagues trying to demonstrate a point. Now, does that mean that you have to agree with Chip Roy on all the social issues and everything else? No. What it means is that Chip Roy, who is someone that you suggest in your book is a problem, is it's a lot more nuanced than we think. There are contradictions everywhere. And by ignoring them and making it more simplistic so we can easily explain it to others, what happens is that we exacerbate the very same problem that we're saying exists. And so that's the only thing I'm trying to point out is that it seems like we are the exact same side of the coin, just the other side of the coin. We're doing the same thing. Like, how are we not?
Let me tell you the way that we deal with this at the end of the book. One of the problems is that people in rural America are too often told that there really is no means within the existing system for them to make their voices heard, to get satisfaction, to address their material problems. And let's take a contrast. You know, the civil rights movement taught African-Americans to this day kind of how you do politics and how it's not how everybody does politics, but there's a path there. You know, there are bills in Congress that you might advocate for, and there are groups who say, you know, we want this bill, and you can have protests and you can do boycotts. And then eventually you get friendly people elected and they pass legislation. And it's a template for how to engage in the democratic system. Rural people haven't been given that template. And so what do you find? You find places where there's very low participation. People don't feel like there is any kind of path within the existing system to engage in politics. And so at the end of the book, we talk about this. Rural whites are one of the core parts of the Republican coalition. And every other part of the Republican coalition and the Democratic coalition has their own set of demands. And so when a Republican is elected president or a Democratic president is elected president, they know that those parts of their coalition are going to have to come to the table and they're going to have to be satisfied. They're going to, you know, the people who are advocate for gun rights, they have a list of things that they want to see. And labor unions on the Democratic side have a list of things that they want to see. Every other part of that coalition has demands. Rural Americans as a group, rural whites, even rural white conservatives, they have no list of demands. And so what you get then is that they are the foundation of Republican power. They are gerrymandered so that they can get a little more leverage to make sure that Republicans control state legislatures. They are an essential part of how Republicans seek and hold power. And yet they have no demands. And so they don't have to be satisfied. And so they elect these people who don't do anything for them. And you mentioned Chip Roy. So that brings up a story that we tell at the end of the book where we went and saw him at an event in rural Texas, which is part of his district. He's got suburban parts of his district and rural parts of his district. And he very nicely talked to us afterward. And we asked him, you know, do you have a particular rural agenda for this part of your constituency? What do they need? What are you trying to get for them? How are you trying to improve their lives? And he looked at us like it was something he had never even thought of before, that they might have their own particular needs. And he, as their representative, might need to do something for them in particular. And so that's just kind of indicative, I think. It's not saying that people should participate. We're saying that they need to participate more. They need to be more active so that they can get what they need from government and have government be an ally in order to improve their lives. That's the whole problem, is that too often their engagement comes in these sort of purely negative ways that are just driven by resentment, but it doesn't turn into something positive that is actually going to help solve these problems that rural America suffers from.
Yeah, engagement, I think, is a big problem. I agree. I do think, though, with the Chip Roy story is very illustrative of a subtext in the book, which is that you have it's high modernism all over again from the 60s. It's like we have experts, we know what's good, this is what people need, this is what they want. And when they don't get that, or they don't vote logically to get that, then somehow there's a problem. Or that dumbfounded, they're being like the dupes of pretended patriots, if we want to take the founding era kind of quote here. But in reality, I think what Chip Roy would say, and probably why he was perplexed when he looked at you, is that his agenda is yes for rural America. But what we have been trained to think, and I think what you both write in your book, is that things, and what you were saying earlier, like with like government support for different things and healthcare and other things, those may be a good idea. That's not my point. That's not what I'm arguing. What I'm saying is that you don't leave room for disagreement over the rural agenda is spending from the federal government targeted expressly to certain constituencies. And there are people out there, for better or worse, and they've been that way since the beginning of the Republic, who disagree with that. That doesn't mean that they don't have a rural agenda. That doesn't mean that they're taking advantage of rural America. And that doesn't mean that rural Americans are dupes. That means that maybe they just disagree. Maybe that Chip Roy's agenda for rural America is let's stop illegal immigration, right? Let's have a more faith-based and social kind of conservative type resurgence in policy. I don't know. It could mean lots of things. But at the end of the day, that doesn't mean that just because you don't support like a highway interchange earmark or some community health center funding that you just like are taking advantage of rural America.
And that's why we didn't. We very specifically chose not to say at the end of the book, you know, here is our 10-point plan to revitalize rural areas. You know, there are lots of experts. You could find those 10-point plans all over the place. What we said when we talked about the need for a rural movement is that those people have to decide for themselves what they want. But the problem is that they're not saying anything that they want now.
So right now they're deciding wrong. I mean, they're deciding wrong in your opinion. I think that's the point. You say they have to decide for themselves, but we just can't imagine why they would continue to vote for people. And I agree that both parties, I think, are just, they just kind of attack each other and don't do anything. And I think that's problematic. But
is anyone in rural America going to say?
Can I say two things in defense of Chip Roy? First of all, you're right, James. Chip Roy signed a memorandum that was sent out by James Massey, his close friend from Kentucky, who said we should not be tearing down the Electoral College. We've won. He said, we've just lost the popular vote seven of the last eight times. Without the Electoral College, there is no President Bush 43 or President Trump. We should be the last people and we should be constitutional defenders. And we credit him for that in the book. And only seven other House Republicans signed it. That's number one. Number two, in his defense, he's not really a rural guy. His base of his district, even though he represents the Texas Hill Country, is the San Antonio suburbs to the north end and the Austin suburbs to the southern end. He's a guy who was born in Bethesda. He worked for Rick Perry, Cornyn, Cruz. He's basically spent his entire life as a political animal in Austin or Washington. He's not some country boy. And by the way, look at who rural people elect. They elect. They hate East Coast elites who go to Yale and Harvard, but they elect people like Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton and other people who really aren't from the area. So, and that's not the Democrats' fault. It's not the liberals' fault. They're electing these J.D. Vance, a guy who worked for a company that represented Purdue Pharma, and then he turns around and tries to blame his mom's addiction on immigrants coming across the border with fentanyl. What a mendacious political ad for a guy like that to run. And, you know, Middletown isn't even that small of a rural town. We read his book in my rural politics class, and the students are like, they're like, I think he's a poser, right? He's not a rural guy. And so they're getting bad representation, and then they're blaming all their problems on faraway cities and essentially the minorities who live there. We know that racial resentment is a strong factor that loads into rural consciousness. All the literature shows that. They believe that the cities get everything and rural America gets nothing, even though there are 400 federal programs specifically targeted to rural America, including 70 at the USDA alone. And that rural Americans, who are overrepresented in the Electoral College, in the Senate, and even in the House, in the U.S. House of Representatives, 40% of the districts are rural or rural suburban. They're 20% of the population. Cities have more people. They only have 20% of the districts. So they're overrepresented in every institution and most of the state legislatures. They should use that power. That's Paul's point. And they're not. They're being sold culture war trinkets, and they're gobbling it up. Because it's just easier. And again, I think you're right, James, because things have gone so bad, and we talk about this in chapter two, Rural Ruin, because things have gone so bad and they feel like I can't control this economy. Jobs have moved out of the state. Technology has replaced coal mining. Family farms have been gobbled up by mass agricultural farms and agribusiness, all of which is not caused by socialism. It's all caused by late stage capitalism, right? Dollar stores have replaced all the mom and pops. That's not socialism. That's capitalism. They feel completely helpless economically. So they may as well vote on cultural issues. You're right, James. They should vote on gods and guns and religion because that's the only place they feel they have a political purchase. But they're voting against their economic interests when they do. They are.
And regardless of what you think the set of policy solutions is that would be more helpful, whether you think it's more government programs or fewer government programs, I guess the question we would ask them is, okay, you're giving all your votes to Republicans. How is that working out? Are you getting like the better life that you want? Are the problems in your communities being solved? Whatever you think the path to the solution is, and it doesn't seem like it's really working out. And that's why we think, you know, at one point we say that they don't necessarily need to just vote for Democrats, but they probably need to get themselves better Republicans who will be more responsive to their needs. And not just somebody who, you know, doesn't barely bothers to campaign and comes in at, you know, at the end of October and says, don't you hate liberals, big city people? Me too. Vote for me. And then they do. And then they don't get anything.
And the consequences, James, are sometimes lethal, fatal. West Virginia was the last state to declare a COVID case. On March 17th, 2020, Trump stood in the White House and said, there's no cases in West Virginia, basically saying, hey, this is an urban city thing. And it's true. At first, when people came to Seattle and Philly and Washington by air, and the big hotspots were Spain and Italy in the early part of COVID, right? It was the Eastern Seaboard, and New York and New Jersey were number one in per capita cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. And West Virginia was 50th, meaning best. Go look at the statistics on the New York webpage now. West Virginia is second to Arizona in COVID deaths per capita. It went from 50th to second, and it's basically tied. Why? Because people there refused to get the vaccines. And according to Pew, rural counties died at 2.4 times the rates of the national average and 3 to 4 times the rates of urban counties during the first Delta wave after the vaccine. Why? Because Donald Trump and conservatives and Republicans said, take ivermectin. It's all a hoax. Let's kill Fauci. They killed their own voters with superstition and scientific skepticism. It literally was a fatal choice for them. because they made a calculus. They said, we might lose 1 or 2% of our voters, but if we tell them the truth about vaccines, we'll lose 70% of them. So let's let our own voters get sick and die and clog up their hospitals so we can win re-election. I hate to sound really cynical about it, but when you look at the statistics in the deaths by population density, there's a direct line. The more dense, less densely populated a county is, the higher it voted for Trump, and the less densely populated a county is, the higher percentage of people who died of COVID. They killed their own voters, right?
I mean, you know, I just, Lee, I'm going to turn over to you. But I mean, look, you're like the voters can, people will decide for themselves. Individuals and families come together and they will decide their views on vaccine. I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but like, so it sounds like, I mean, it's like you're, it's like, we now know the answer. We know the truth. We know what is good and holy and just. And therefore anybody who stands in our way is like to hell with them. And so they don't have a choice. They don't have a choice. It's their choice. They get to decide the stuff in a state. The state of West Virginia, public health policy is a state level thing for good or bad. And like, I'm not saying it's a good thing policy wise all the time. I'm just saying that politics is about a place where an activity happens and you kind of get half of that. But then it's like, but then you're like, but we know what the outcome of that activity ought to be. And so therefore, any activity that produces a different outcome, it's not okay. It's a threat. It's a threat to democracy. It's a threat to politics. It's a threat to everything. When in reality, it's just people. Look, if something's crazy, you know, the best way to get it out in the open is to talk about it, and to have engagement and to force people. And I agree, that is a big problem right now, that people aren't engaging on all sides. And this is a key difference in the past.
So let me try to wrap this up, because there's a lot of heated disagreement before politics in question turns into crossfire.
we don't want that. Thank you for coming on. I like arguing. Yeah.
Debate is, it can be productive, but you know, I think there's a really important point that you guys make in this book, you know, is about the lack of a rural movement that allows rural people to be taken advantage, right? Because politics is about participation. Politics is also about organization and representation. And this was something that you discussed at the very beginning of this podcast, Tom, you know, where you talked about how these places have become completely uncompetitive, right? I mean, there are a lot of one-party places. So, James, when you say, well, people can choose, but if Democrats are not really competing in a lot of these places because they don't see a chance at winning, and then there's no real accountability for the Republicans who represent these places. And you know, I think this is a real problem, that despite having geographic overrepresentation in our political system, that rural American has political underrepresentation, because we are in a place where most of these districts are one-party districts. Most of these states are one-party states. Most of these regions are one-party regions. And when you don't have meaningful political competition, it's really hard for voters to have meaningful choice and meaningful accountability. And you don't have that competition that comes from parties offering new programs. I mean, you can argue one reason that the civil rights movement was so successful in the 1960s is because both parties were competing for civil rights for Black voters, that they were sort of in between the two parties and they played a pivotal role. Right now, in most parts of the country, it's suburban voters who play that pivotal role and some suburban districts.
I think a multi-party system might be the solution.
Well, that's what I think. I don't know. I mean,
we should change the electoral voting rules. You guys are the polarization experts. You tell us how to.
Whatever you do, though, you got to plug your book like Lee does. He is a machine. It's so, I mean, I love the book. It's a great book, and it's a valuable lesson that we all need to take away. Which is,
well, you know, I wrote it because I saw this problem in so many aspects of our politics. Right? I mean, rural versus urban. That's constructed binary. Really, there's a continuum. And you know, we're talking this entire episode about trying to find the nuance and the multidimensionality, but in a binary system, we collapse these things, right? I mean, this is part of the debate, James, that you and Tom were having is, you know, I think you felt that Tom was trying to oversimplify the rural American consciousness, and Tom was explaining how rural America is exploited by cynical Republican politicians because rural America doesn't have any choice. So, I mean, I I hate to be too much of a hedgehog here, but I do think that the party system is the megastructure of our politics, and it's what constructs all of our conflicts, and electoral choices shape how people view politics. And the fact that rural America right now is really one-party America is really bad for rural America, in the same way that I think urban America being one-party America is also really bad for urban America. And I think there are some real problems in cities that Democrats are not fully addressing because there's no real competition. So
I think we could all agree on that.
Yes.
I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah. All right. Well, glad to bring us to some agreement after a spirited debate, which we love having here on Politics in Question, because if we knew all the answers, there would be no podcast.
That's right. But thank you. I mean, both of you, and Tom, especially, I love sparring and arguing, and I try to do it with Lee all the time. So thank you for coming on and letting me
spar with you. Thanks for your time. Yeah. We appreciate it.
And thanks a lot,
James.
Paul,
thanks. And the book is also very, we don't emphasize this enough, it's well-written, which, you know, most books today are not well-written. So
I enjoyed it.
It was an enjoyable read. Like, so thank you.
That's kind of,
I liked it. I think people should read it.
It's hard to be a co-author too, right? You know, I don't know if you guys have co-authored, but I've solo authored and co-authored, and it's hard to find a shared voice. It's harder to write.
I just do whatever Lee says when we write together. But but no, thank you. We'll make sure it's in the show notes, and we'll make sure that all of our listeners, because I think whether you are inclined to think you agree or disagree with it, it is the kind of thing that you need to engage with and to think about. And I think that that is absolutely paramount. So thank you for coming on the podcast, for tolerating my kind of strident tirades at times. But thank you.
It's all good. All right.
Yep.
Cheers. All right. Well, this has been another episode of Politics in Question.
Thank you for listening to Politics in Question. This podcast is a joint production between New America and the R Street Institute. Our producer is Sarah Jacob. Our audio engineer is Shannon Lynch. Theme music composed and performed by yours truly. Please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.